This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
It's good to be back after a couple of week hiatus. I want to welcome you to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Israel's historic reconciliation with its neighbors looks like it is continuing, with yet another nation showing signs of abandoning a policy of hostility toward the Jewish state. To learn about this, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, no one has really expected that one of the nations that might be warming towards Israel would be Lebanon, the nation to Israel's north, just because that nation also is beholden largely still to Hezbollah, which is just a proxy of Iran. This is one of Iran's chief terrorist groups that has 150,000 missiles that are aiming towards Israel at this moment. And yet we did have a breakthrough between Lebanon and Israel, and this has been pushed by the United States and also France. For the first time in 30 years, Israel and Lebanon sat at a table to discuss discuss issues together. Well, technically, they weren't at the same table. They were in the same tent. The Israeli side was in one room, and the Lebanese side was in another room, and they would each talk to the United States, and the United States would pass on what was said to the other side and back and forth. This doesn't sound like much, but it's huge. It's the first time that they've been together for 30 years, and what they were discussing was a resolution of the maritime borders between Israel and Lebanon. There is disputed territory on the border out at sea between the two countries, and this is territory that is potentially highly valuable for its gas, natural gas deposits, or natural gas that is there in the Eastern Mediterranean. This is something that Lebanon wants to have access to, and if it is to have access to that source of income, it must deal with Israel and resolve its maritime issue. Now, this doesn't seem like much, but a lot of commentators have come out and talked about how if Hezbollah was strong inside Lebanon, and since they are the chief actor in Lebanon, they would not allow these talks to go forward with Israel, a warming of a relationship with Israel. They would rather stick to their funding sources in Iran, stick to wielding the incredible power they have, stick to showing Israel as the enemy, which, because Israel's the enemy, it justifies Hezbollah's existence in the eyes of the other Lebanese, because this is the defense that Lebanon has against Israeli aggression. However, Hezbollah and the rest of the Lebanese were willing to sit down and negotiate something with Israel, weaken the image that Israel is the enemy that has been sold to the Lebanese public, because Lebanon is in such dire situation right now that we've talked about post Beirut explosion, and Hezbollah's power itself has been severely diminished, that they would allow such negotiations to go forward.
Well, that's really the issue, isn't it? That this indicates the degree to which Hezbollah's position within Lebanon has been weakened over the last couple of months.
Right. And that's what one of our writers for the Trumpet, one of our student writers, Mariana Bala, who wrote this article that's going up. She's actually part Lebanese, and so I've been throwing a lot of Lebanese stories towards her just because of a bit of her family history there. But she listened to a former Israeli general give a talk in Jerusalem via Zoom this week about how Hezbollah's power is in fact dwindling. Hezbollah is still powerful in Lebanon, but post-blast, a lot of the Lebanese people that are not in bed with Hezbollah but have accepted Hezbollah's rule over them, a lot of them are getting very upset that their country is not being able to go forward with relationships with the outside world, because everyone sees all of Lebanon as beholden to Hezbollah. Why is the rest of the world going to do business deals and help out the Lebanese if that money is just going to fund a terrorist organization for the Iranians, and nobody's doing it? And so there is extreme amounts of pressure to on Hezbollah to give a little bit right here, to give in to the rest of the Lebanese, to show itself willing, even if it won't do a photo up with the Israelis, to at least back some talks. Now, we don't expect Hezbollah to change its stripes necessarily and start loving Israel, but we do expect the Lebanese themselves to increasingly see Hezbollah as the reason that it is not able to go forward as a country and be welcomed from the rest of the world. And with these talks, they are again a sign that Hezbollah is starting to feel this pain and it is feeling threatened with its power inside Lebanon.
Now, this is important for us. It's something that is really throws up flags for the Trumpet staff because of things that we've been saying about Lebanon and specifically Hezbollah's position within Lebanon for decades.
Right. We do expect Lebanon, because of a biblical prophecy, that it is going to change its alliances from being in bed with Iran. Instead, it's going to come out on the other side, that in an alliance that we see forming in the Middle East right now. We see these alliances between moderate Arab states alongside Israel, really, against the Iranian force. And this prophecy found in Psalm 83 describes the inhabitants of Tyre, which is southern Lebanon. It describes also Gebal. These are ancient names referring to nations and peoples that are in existence today in Psalm 83. It's an alliance that's never come to fruition anciently, and so it is a biblical prophecy, even though it's a psalm. And based on that, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, has said that we expect the Iranian hold on Lebanon to weaken, and that this has accelerated this prophecy towards fulfillment post explosion in Beirut on August 4th, and stories are coming out every single week, not just by us, but by other commentators noting the weakened state of Hezbollah inside that country. And so we are going to keep our eyes on it, because as Hezbollah falls in power of Lebanon, biblical prophecy is being fulfilled there.
Well, we do have this article that Brent mentioned. Historic maritime talks with Israel show Hezbollah's weakened grip on Lebanon, that is going up on the Trumpet site very soon. We also, that article links to what we've been saying about Lebanon for some years now. Gerald Flory wrote an article, Why We Told You to Watch Lebanon, and we have a trend article explaining the alliance between Arab nations and Europe that Brent just described. We'll link to all of those in the show notes for today's program. We thank you very much for that, Brent. Some alarming comments from South Korea's ambassador to the U.S. suggest a fraying in the 70-year alliance between these two countries. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, there have actually been a couple of powerful voices in South Korea just saying that the nation can and should walk away from its military alliance with the United States. So this week, South Korea's ambassador to the U.S., Mr. Lee Soo-hyuk, spoke up about this. This is, he's the man whose job is mainly to manage the relationship between South Korea and America. But now he's really making this case for the South to just very seriously consider ending the relationship. On Monday, he was addressing the National Assembly's Foreign Affairs and Unification Committee, and he said, quote, "Just because Korea chose the U.S. 70 years ago does not mean it has to choose the U.S. for the next 70 years, too." And then from there, he went on to say that the South should consider drawing nearer to China instead. He said, "The Korea-U.S. alliance is not only military, but is a comprehensive one with economic, social, and cultural aspects. But when we see from the past conflicts with China, like the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Row, then we've seen the importance of China from economic aspects." So, you know, these were some very bold remarks, really, and they follow similar statements that Mr. Lee made back in June of this year, basically just saying the same thing, that South Korea doesn't need to kowtow to the U.S. and that it should instead draw closer to China. And then just last week, the chairman of South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff told the South Korean parliament that the government needs to transfer wartime operational control of South Korean forces from Washington to Seoul. So right now, the U.S. has command over the South Korean military. But more and more South Koreans, including now the chairman of South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff, wants that to end. So, you know, these kinds of statements are becoming more and more frequent and more urgent. And they do come at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump has been applying pressure on South Korea and other U.S. allies. So it's not a huge surprise to see the South sending these kinds of messages. But it is sobering, I think, when you consider what's at stake for the U.S. and for the world, really.
Well, yeah, maybe you could just put what's happening here in its historical context a bit and just describe the importance of this alliance between the United States and South Korea and what America stands to lose if that actually fractures.
Yes, well, the United States has right now about 28,500 troops at various locations in South Korea. And America also has the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense that I mentioned there. That's the THAAD missile system. Mr. Lee mentioned that as being something that antagonizes China a great deal. And having all of those troops and that advanced missile defense system on the Korean Peninsula, those are just invaluable tools that help the United States contain threats from Russia, from China, from North Korea. And as I mentioned, also in the event of war, America has command over the South Korean military. That's the world's 11th most powerful military. So that all adds up to just really bolster America's power in East Asia and to deter some of those revisionist nations from a lot of their acts of aggression. So if that South Korea-U.S. mutual defense treaty were to fall apart, that could just fundamentally change the balance of power in Asia. And there's also the fact that it could undermine, you know, the general credibility of America's security guarantees. I think we could even see a domino effect. We could see some of the NATO countries and Japan just kind of saying, why have we been relying on America for all these years? And they could begin to focus even more on building their own military capabilities. So, you know, I think it's just very sobering to see South Korea saying that they may not want the U.S. military there anymore, partly because that would just be such a victory for China and for Russia.
This is really part of what we've seen, a larger trend throughout Asia. The Philippines, Japan, other Asian nations that maybe had stronger ties with the United States in the past that seem to be pulling away from that in response to what China is doing in the region. Can you just put this in prophetic context for us?
Sure, yeah. This is something that The Trumpet and our forerunner magazine, The Plain Truth, have been saying for decades would happen. Because Bible prophecy says in places like Leviticus 26:19 that God will break the pride in America's power, and that U.S. power will decline in Asia and everywhere else. And then prophecy also shows that several Asian nations will rise up and become powerful and unified during an age that the Bible calls the times of the Gentiles. And we've already seen this shift gradually happening in its early phases for several years. And if South Korea and the U.S., and as you mentioned, the Philippines and Japan and other countries there, if they continue to clash regarding their ties with America, it could lead to more major steps in that direction. So, yeah, I would just encourage listeners to order a free copy of our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. It goes through all of the Bible prophecies and examines the geopolitical trends that are really fulfilling those prophecies right now to show that this tectonic shift is happening right now.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. The Pope recently published a long letter describing his recommendations for how the world should deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, and it is quite intriguing. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, it was certainly a long letter, his longest yet, talking about the way forward for the world after coronavirus, a new kind of world economy that he wants around the corner. And I think there's a couple of interesting takeaways from it. The first is that it is being seen by quite a lot of people as an intervention in the U.S. presidential election. The Washington Post, for example, their headline on that was the Pope's unexpected, or one of their headlines, the Pope's unexpected election message. So they saw it as him coming out and putting a very strong push towards Joe Biden. The National Catholic Reporter as well talked about how how left or right wing Catholics needed to go and read this letter. Going back to that Washington Post, it says that that this will make it hard for conservatives and right wing Catholics to insist the only Orthodox vote is for Mr. Trump. And it does contain the kind of the coded language, you know, not mentioning President Trump right out by name that you would kind of expect from this kind of thing. It, for example, it talks about those that build a culture of walls to raise walls, walls in the heart, walls on the land, in order to prevent this encounter with other cultures, other people. And those who raise walls will end up slaves within the very walls they have built. That's quite a strong criticism of a politician who 4 years ago ran on a platform of build the wall. And then there's a lot of as well of this, attack of politicians who might be put their own country's interests first. That permeates the whole thing. That's one of his strongest themes there. You know, politicians that would put their own countries first, to him are one of the roots of all evil in this world. So that's a pretty direct condemnation of President Trump's whole philosophy. There's a lot in there as well about supporting migrants, how migrants should be allowed to come in from other countries, that if they're fleeing war or if they just want better economic circumstances, great, welcome them in. And then you put this side by side with the fact that recently, and Andrew wrote about this week, you had Mike Pompeo visiting the Vatican wanting to talk about China's human rights abuses, and the Vatican said, no, we don't want to talk to you, we don't want to, the Pope will not meet with you, we don't want to have anything that could be interpreted as us supporting the Trump campaign. You've got quite a they're making clear where they stand, and they stand behind Joe Biden. So I think that's one part of it. And then we've seen that throughout the whole of President Trump's tenure so far. And then, okay, there's all these problems in this world. It talks about a lot of problems. There's a lot of attack on capitalism. It talks about, for example, private property. The right to private property shouldn't be – it's a secondary right, it says. It's not a fundamental right. Doesn't really quite go into how you square that with thou shalt not steal. That seems to establish property rights pretty clearly. But anyway, it attacks some of the basic foundations of capitalism. It sets up a lot of kind of straw men that purport to be capitalist arguments and strike them down. So a lot of it is an attack on capitalism, which, again, we see a lot from this Pope as a thinly veiled attack on the United States. And the solution, though, is multilateralism, is nations getting together and working together. And the one that's held up really even right from page two of the document as the way to do this is the European Union. And, yeah, there's some criticism in there for the EU's movement towards being a united block has slowed down, and so it has some criticism. But in general, you know, that's the way forward. Nations working together like the European Union, good. Nations putting their own self-interest first, and capitalism, bad. That's basically the overall message from this longest letter from the Pope.
When you hear the Pope talking about internationalism, multilateralism along these lines, this is the type of language that you hear from the left a lot, but when it's coming from the Vatican, it does have historical associations that it doesn't have from other organizations. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is one of the big themes of Pope Francis's papacy. And if you want to know more about this, I just start off right now by mentioning the chapter in our Holy Roman Empire booklet. There's a chapter in there called The Seventh and Final Resurrection Now Here. And that talks about this economic power rising in Europe, prophesied in the Bible. But one of the things, and this chapter in particular connects that really strongly with the Vatican. And the Bible makes that connection. It's based off of Bible prophecies. And that chapter talks about what we've seen already from Pope Francis in pushing this European power. I mean, we mentioned some of his other letters, and a number of those other letters are brought up in this chapter. There's one there, Evangelii Gaudium, or Joy of the Gospel. This was one of his first ones. that was in response to the global financial crisis, and it was all about a complete overhaul of the world's financial system. I think that's how Reuters even summarized that particular one. And then there was another one afterwards, Laudato Si, Be Praised. This was another landmark one that talked again about, well, we've got these environmental crises, economic crises. Again, we need, he talked about, we need a true world political authority in that letter. And again, we need a whole new system, and a system underwritten by moral purpose and a moral guidance and guardian. And this letter just really follows on in that same spirit. We need nations working together. We need organizations like the European Union. We need a new financial system. And you can really see what it's, what you put these together, you can see what it's getting for. It's talking about a new financial system not based on America, and one that the Catholic Church is there, you know, maybe as he would say, to provide the conscience for this financial system so that it would be different from the heartless capitalism that he kind of describes. And so you can see how he's pushing for a new financial system dominated by the Catholic Church. And that is exactly what the Bible talks about. You know, Revelation 17 talks about this rise of this power led by a woman, a church in Bible symbolism. Revelation 18 starts to get into how all the merchants benefit from this and how there's a new economic system. Now, obviously, after those previous two letters, the world didn't drop everything and create those systems. But you look at the massive amounts of debt in America's financial system, in the West right now. You know, I don't really agree with most of the Pope's criticisms, but the current financial system can't last. Mm-hmm. It's going to collapse. It's probably going to cause a whole lot of suffering in that collapse, not just in America. And you can see how after that happens, the Catholic Church has positioned itself well to step forward and say, well, we were calling for a new system, and then to even be part of the redrawing of that system. So that chapter of that book, the Seventh and Final Resurrection of the Holy Roman or the Seventh and Final Resurrection now here, talks about what the Bible says, and also just shows how closely involved the Catholic Church is in world politics, world diplomacy, and the European Union, and how they really are being all set to take on that prophesied role.
Yeah, you don't necessarily see a lot of overt influence being extended, but you certainly see the ideological direction that the Vatican would take, and you put it together with the history. You're talking about the seventh and final resurrection now here. There were six that preceded it that you can look at historically, and you see just how politically involved the Vatican was in European affairs in those Holy Roman Empire resurrections. And as you said, you see the groundwork being laid for that today. Thank you very much for that, Richard. And do check that out. Our Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy booklet is just packed with information about the history and the prophecy of this political religious union. In the United States, confirmation hearings wrapped up for what looks like will be the next justice on the Supreme Court, and a historic change in the composition of that court. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, unless something really unexpected happens, Amy Barrett set to be confirmed to the Supreme Court on October 26, just 8 days before the election. They held the confirmation hearings this week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Actually, they wrapped up Thursday. And Mitch McConnell's confident that he has 51 Republican votes to get her confirmed before the election. Probably kind of contentious from a historical standpoint, but definitely kind of tame compared to the last couple confirmation processes we've had.
Thankfully.
For the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
I guess I don't think Democrats want to rock the boat too much before the election, especially considering that, like I said, the Republicans have the 51 votes. So, whether they make a fuss or not, this is looks like that something really unexpected happens. This is happening. A lot of the criticism they seem to focus in on. I mean, there were definitely questions over her opposition to abortion and her stance on like homosexual marriage and issues regarding that. It seemed like a lot of their focus came in on healthcare They're saying, well, with COVID-19, we don't want to judge who's going to rule anyway that's going to hurt, like Obamacare. And that's seemed to be their main effort, is to latch on to something to get maybe some conservatives to turn against her. But yeah, Amy Barrett, she did a really good job at coming back and just sticking to the trunk of the tree, is like, what is a judge supposed to do? Mm-hmm. Where she confirmed that, she said she's going to interpret the Constitution and the laws of the United States as they're written. She had one particularly good quote where she says, judges can't just wake up one day and say, I have an agenda, I like guns, I hate guns, I like abortion, I hate abortion, and then walk in like a royal queen and impose their will on the world. You have to wait for cases and controversies, which is the language of the Constitution, to wind their way through the process. Basically making the same point that the late Antonin Scalia made so often, that like a judge's responsibility is to tell people what the law says. You can't make up your own laws, mm-hmm. which shouldn't be controversial. Like, right. And in this case, like in talking with liberals who are concerned about healthcare laws, they're like, well, if you're concerned about a certain healthcare law and you want healthcare to be different, then you need to go through the work of passing a new law, and then the courts can uphold that law. But they're like, right now it's the judge's responsibility is just to tell you, like, these are the laws we have, and this is what we say. We can't create new healthcare programs from the judicial bench.
Because Ms. Barrett is replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was arguably the most liberal justice, or she was certainly among the most liberal justices on the court, and to replace her with a strict constitutionalist like Barrett, this really would completely alter the overall ideological composition of the court, or not ideological, but judicial philosophy of the court, which has a lot of conservatives very excited and a lot of liberals really, really angry.
Yeah, this will definitely be, if she gets confirmed, one of the most conservative courts for decades. Some say the most conservative court since 1950. Some push it back all the way to like 1939. Because it is, even Republican-appointed judges, you look over the past century, is they're often times, just as chance would have it, appointed by a Republican, but then confirmed by a Democrat-controlled Senate. That's how we got Anthony Kennedy and John Roberts, appointed by Republicans, but liberal Republicans, because you had to get through the confirmation process with a Senate controlled by liberals. So it's been fairly rare in the last 100 years for something like this to happen, where you've got not just justice appointed by a Republican replacing a very liberal justice, but a justice appointed by a Republican and then confirmed by a Republican Senate. So they can go very conservative here. So that's going to just really change the composition of the court, which brings us back to a point our editor-in-chief made in an article after Brett Kavanaugh was appointed, titled, Is America's Supreme Court in Bible Prophecy? And in the introductory paragraphs of that, he talked about how much the composition of the court was changing with Kavanaugh's appointment. And then this is, with Barrett's appointment, it's just the shift is an order of magnitude more dramatic than that, just because she's replacing a justice that was so liberal. But yeah, Mr. Fleury, in that article, he goes through a prophecy, explaining that Amos 7 is an end time prophecy about America in an era ruled by a president or a leader who's a type of the ancient King Jeroboam II. And then it talks about in Amos 7 that King Jeroboam II, he's supported by two institutions, one called the King's Chapel, which is a religious movement, and then the other called the Kingdom's Court, which is like it's a political movement. It's like a court or a plaza where they're like there's a government buildings. And Mr. Fleury makes the point that the Supreme Court is part of that King's Court, as is many of the executive agencies, making the point for this prophecy to be fulfilled of the kingdom's court supporting the Jeroboam figure, you are going to need a much more conservative Supreme Court than the one President Trump inherited when he took office. And this is the biggest fulfillment of that shift of creating a conservative court we've seen. I mean, this is the third judge, the third justice President Trump has appointed, but it's really the first one that's made a major shift in the court's ideology with Neil Gorsuch replacing Antonin Scalia. There wasn't a much of a shift. And then Brett Kavanaugh, there was more of a shift. That's why Mr. Fleury wrote this article. But then with, Amy Barrett replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg, this is a massive shift towards a conservative court that would rule according to what the law says, but follow a judicial philosophy much more in line with the president and the other people he's appointing to the government.
Is America's Supreme Court in Bible Prophecy is the name of the article from Gerald Fleury. Go check that out. We'll link to that in the show notes for today's program. And thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, protests continue in Kyrgyzstan and a disputed territory in Central Asia is at war. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A lot of unrest is boiling in the former territory of the Soviet Union, and eyes are on Russian President Vladimir Putin to see what he will do about it. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I think the most eye-catching of several of these developments is the war that's broken out in the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh. Between Azerbaijan and Armenia. And you've got the situation now where you've got two countries with pretty modern militaries and tanks now fighting off against each other. And you've got cities that look Western, modern, pretty well developed, now coming under artillery fire, people having sheltering in their basements or fleeing town. One of the biggest cities in Nagorno-Karabakh has come under attack, and the same for one of the biggest Armenian cities over the border. So I think part of it is just a sobering reminder of the world that we live in, and that you have wars that can break out. And it's always sobering, I think, when you see some of these things. We tend to think of war as something very foreign, but when you see some places that you could kind of almost imagine living in coming under attack like that, it does sober you a bit. And then you're seeing some of the ways modern technology affect war. Azerbaijan has been using drones very successfully against some of Armenia's tanks. They can get in some of these. They're willing to risk having a drone shot down. It's a cheap, easy to replace thing, not like a massively expensive fighter jet. So they'll send these in these areas, and they've been quite successful in destroying tanks from above. And it's one of the biggest outbreaks of violence since you had this conflict over 30 years ago. The situation there is you've got this region, Nagorno-Karabakh, claimed by both sides. Most of the world recognizes it as part of Azerbaijan, but Armenia won the war 30 years ago or so. It's mostly Armenians that live there. And so it looks like Azerbaijan has decided they're going to go in there and take it back. Behind a lot of this instability could be Turkey. It looks they're very close to Azerbaijan. They've got strong links. There are reports, I don't think definitively yet, but reports of Turkey taking fighters from Syria to Azerbaijan for use here. There's reports of Turkey sending in aircraft, Turkish F-16s being involved in the conflict. But you've got this situation going on in the Caucasus there, and it's something that you've got a lot of people watching. It directly affects Iran, it directly affects Russia, it directly affects Europe because a lot of their gas supplies comes through this area. And as you mentioned, this isn't the only place where you've got chaos going on. Kyrgyzstan, They just had a disputed parliamentary election. There have been protests. The president just announced that he was stepping down yesterday. So you've got kind of a big political turmoil going on there, and it's it looks like a regime change there, with violent protests after these parliamentary elections. There have been one dead and 1,000 injured in clashes between the protesters and police. The demonstrators stormed government buildings. They freed opposition lawmakers from jail. One of those opposition lawmakers has actually been was put in as prime minister by the president before he resigned to try and step down on some of this unrest. And then, of course, you've got Belarus, that situation that we've talked about before on this show, where the longstanding dictator claims to have won the last election by an absurdly large margin. And you've got ongoing protests trying to kick him out, and the European Union refusing to recognize him as the leader of Belarus anymore. So a lot of this different turmoil all around these different areas in Eastern Europe and Central Asia.
All three of these countries, all of these areas that you're talking about, former Soviet territory. Russia has bases in several of these countries. A lot of people are looking at Putin and what he will do. And to this point, his efforts to try to quell the violence in this disputed territory you're describing has not yielded much fruit. A lot of people saying, what is he going to do next?
Yeah, I think this represents a big opportunity for Vladimir Putin. Not necessarily an easy opportunity. It's not something that he's got in the bag. But it's an opportunity to increase Russian power in all of these areas. You're already seeing that to a certain extent in Belarus, where Lukashenko there, he wants to be kind of independent from Putin. He doesn't want to be just a puppet on a string. But at the same time, if it's a choice between being Putin's puppet or having being defenestrated by the mob, he'll choose to be Putin's puppet. And the protests there are pushing him to be more reliant on President Putin. I think you could have the possibility for a similar dynamic in Central Asia, where Armenia is a strong Russian ally, but they've been moving towards being more kind of Western and European in recent years. And this pressure could well force them back into Russia's camp. You could see how the unrest in Kyrgyzstan, it could also be an opportunity for Vladimir Putin to bring his control more into those areas. So all of these, there's opportunities there for Vladimir Putin. And there's some incredibly specific forecasts that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has made based on Bible prophecy that make this important to watch. I think if you listen to the show for any length of time, you're familiar with this prophecy about a prince of Rosh from Ezekiel 38. There's a forecast there that there's going to be this prince of Rosh, or prince of Russia, as you could read it. And this chapter makes very clear it's talking about the latter years, talking about the end times. There's going to be a strong leader in Russia. But it doesn't just call him the prince of Rosh. It calls him the prince of Meshech and Tubal. It talks about these other regions, and you can go through, and if you study those, you can see how this is all referring to different regions of Russia. But Mr. Flurry, he wrote in the book that we have on this subject, the use of all three names, Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, shows that this is an individual ruler of all the people of Russia, from west to east. This reference to the cities of Moscow and Tobolsk helps us see how vast Russian territory is in these latter days. This giant swath of land indicates the prince will probably conquer more nations of the former Soviet Union. So I'm not sure exactly how long ago Mr. Flurry first wrote that. I think it must be 5 or 6 years ago. But he's saying, well, look, the Bible indicates he's going to be conquering more territory. And you're seeing events line up very nicely for him to extend his influence into more of this territory. It's another detail where world events just line up precisely with what you see in the Bible. That quote is from our book, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. That will tell you much more about this forecast, but it's one that you can see being fulfilled on the scene right now. And we have another article, Has Putin's Hour Come, that's on our website, that talks about what what more of the details of this news story and how that's been developing.
Yeah, quite an excellent article there from Mihailo Zekic. It was a Trumpet brief this week. Has Putin's hour come? Go check that out on the website. We'll link to it on our show notes, as well as that booklet from Gerald Fleury, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. Thanks for unpacking all of that for us, Richard. We spoke in the first half about the thawing relations between Israel and Lebanon. Really, so much of this started with this historic deal the Jews made with the United Arab Emirates recently. That deal went through the Israeli Knesset this week. To learn more about this, we'll go back to Brent Nachtigal.
There was a rare moment of Israeli consensus inside the Knesset this Thursday when 80 members of the Knesset did vote to accept the terms of normalization of this peace deal with the United Arab Emirates. The only people that opposed to it that were there present were the joint list of Arabs, the joint list of Arab parties there. They are against it, apparently. The Palestinians are against peace, but all the Israelis, left, right, everyone else is for it. And so this was the second last hurdle before it becomes official. It's got to go back to the cabinet, which should be just a technicality over the next day or so. And then it will be, have to be, obviously, make its way through the constitutional process in the United Arab Emirates. And then finally, you will have this peace accord that, though it's signed, just it's going back through their local parliaments. And really, this is a really stunning turnaround. As you said, the thaw between Israel and Arab states did start with this shock announcement back in early August, August 13th or 14th, it was, from President Trump that he's arranging this peace deal. And Bahrain, of course, has jumped on this. And then there's rumors this week that Saudi Arabia is really close. Saudi Arabia said that normalization with Israel is always the goal, but we're going to work with the Palestinians first, which is really an interesting hint because they haven't said that before, that is, that they wanted to have normalization with Israel going forward. And so we are seeing a big sea change in the Middle East, and it is being hailed as a peace agreement that is based on good mutual feelings of goodwill. That's what the Prime Minister talked about in the Knesset on Thursday. We, of course, have a different take on this peace deal, and we take a more sobering look at the peace deal between Israel and Arab states based on the biblical prophecy we talked about in the first half, found in Psalm chapter 83. And I would like to just recall something that took place last week. We didn't have a program last week, but a significant event took place in regards to Israel's relationship with these Arab states and also the other key player in this prophecy in Psalm 83. Back last Tuesday, we had the first visit, face-to-face meeting between the foreign ministers of Israel, the UAE as well. And that visit and that meeting took place in Germany. And it took place at the Holocaust Museum Memorial there in Germany, and it was with the foreign minister of Germany there as well. And this is what the foreign minister said, and it is important for everyone that, to listen to this that follows this prophecy. He said this, quote, Heiko Maas called it a great honor that the Israeli and Emirati foreign ministers picked Berlin as the site of their historic first meeting. The most important currency in diplomacy is trust, and I am personally thankful to both my colleagues that they are placing this trust in Germany. So up until now, there was no instance that Germany would have a role inside the peace agreements between Israel, the Arab states that were mediated by the United States. And yet, our editor-in-chief back in the late September did a program, the Key of David program, entitled the Psalm 83 Prophecy. And he said that, just wait, Germany is going to become involved in this. Germany is a central player in this Psalm 83 alliance of moderate states that Israel is going to actually end up trusting. And we saw that. We saw that that trust is now being placed in Germany as a mediator between Arabs and Israelis. Just one quote from this program. Mr. Fleury says this, but you can believe this, that what you're seeing in the Middle East right now is beginning of this unity that they're trying to achieve in the Middle East. But Germany is going to move in, and they're going to do it uniting, going to do the uniting themselves. Get ready for Germany to move in on this relationship. 2 weeks after he said that, or a week and a half, that was the location for the first meeting of the foreign ministers. So people do really need to look at what's really happening with this peace agreement with Israel and other Arab states. Germany is going to be involved, as the prophecy says in Psalm 83. And we saw some really good, strong proof of that over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, Germany's position in that alliance, that's certainly clear in prophecy, and also the duplicitous nature of the relationship between that Germany is forging with Israel, that's also discussed in prophecy.
Yeah, Mr. Flory says on that same program, he says, so it's talking about how that Bible prophecy based on a scripture in Daniel chapter 11, verse 41, talks about how Israel is actually going to welcome into its country German-led forces. And why do they do this? Mr. Flory says, so everything indicates they're letting them do this because they want to have peace with, well, Germany and the moderate Arabs. They think they already have peace with them, but they're in for a big double cross if they don't listen to God. The double cross is going to come when Israel, who believes they have peace with the moderate Arab states and also Germany, is welcomed into their country. Mm-hmm. And there is going to be a double cross there. That's what the Bible says. And this, what we're seeing the last couple of weeks is really setting up that prophecy for us.
Well, we will definitely need to write up what is happening here. In the meantime, go check out that Key of David program from Gerald Flory, Psalm 83 Prophecy, from just a few weeks ago. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Japan's militarization continues this week with unveiling a new submarine class. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Japan launched this new class of submarine off the coast of Kobe on Wednesday. So Kobe is well known for its beef, but it's also home to one of Japan's main shipyards. And the new submarine that they just launched there is a 3,000-ton model. It's called the Taigei, or the Big Whale. And the Big Whale is basically just a larger and quieter version of Japan's advanced Soryu-class submarine. And what keeps this so quiet is its use of an advanced lithium battery system. These are recharged with diesel generators, and they're just, you know, insanely quiet, which makes the submarines very difficult to detect. The subs are also able to stay underwater for far longer than any of their predecessors. Japan hasn't published details about what weapons it'll be outfitted with, but this is a $720 million submarine. It accommodates a crew of 70, and this is Japan's 22nd military sub, so that's quite a fleet. And the Big Whale will be in sea trials for the next several months, and then it'll go into operational employment. And when that happens, it'll add quite a lot to Japan's so-called self-defense force.
This is part of a trend that we've seen in Japan's militarization efforts over quite some time.
It is, yeah. It was 75 years ago now that Japan and its fanatical wartime militarism were defeated by the U.S. and the Allied powers. And the U.S. at that time made Japan renounce war and enshrine pacifism into their constitution. And in the beginning, that was a binding restriction on Japan. But, you know, over those 75 years, little by little, we've seen the Japanese make incremental moves toward rearming. They've quietly reinterpreted that part of their constitution. They've found reasons to justify all kinds of major steps toward militarism. Some of these reasons are certainly valid, such as China's rising belligerence in the area. And that's a huge factor with Japan's buildup. But Japan now, it's really silly, I think, to call it a demilitarized pacifist country, even though that clause remains officially in the constitution. Because by most metrics, Japan today has the world's sixth most powerful military. And with, you know, with this new class of war submarines coming online, it's just set to keep on growing more and more powerful. And I think it's interesting that right now, a lot of this military buildup that we see happening in Asia, it's the result of Asian nations' fear of each other. Because the Bible shows that in the end, these countries will actually be working together as an Asian bloc. The Bible talks about this this confederacy of nations in all kinds of passages, but the most detailed one is actually the one that Richard mentioned a moment ago, Ezekiel 38. And that one, it talks about some of the specific countries that'll take part in it. And it shows, as Richard said, that Russia will be the head nation. But if you go to verse 6, it also mentions some ancient names for the peoples that make up modern Japan. So when we see things like these incredibly advanced submarines coming online, it's really setting the stage for that end-time Asian bloc to be a formidable military power.
Hmm. Well, we do have a trend article on our website, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism. You can go check that out for more about the prophecies that inform our analysis of this situation. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. One final story. This from the U.S. Explosive new information emerged this week about the family of Democrat presidential candidate Joe Biden. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, after the Senate released a new report on much of the business corruption involved with the Biden family, especially Joe Biden's son, Hunter, presidential candidate Joe Biden first came out and said that he didn't know anything about all this. He hadn't talked to his sons about his overseas business ventures. And then during the presidential debates, he came out and said that it was all lies. Well, now they've actually got a laptop from Hunter Biden confirming that not only did his father know about these business contacts, but he was actually getting a sizable cut of the profits. Hunter Biden, he dropped off his laptop at a repair shop and then didn't pick it up for so long that the repair shop just claimed ownership of it and found all the emails and documents regarding his business connections in Ukraine and in Kazakhstan and in Russia and in China. And the email that I just mentioned specifically was about with the Ukrainian government, where he was sitting on the board of an energy company in Ukraine, but because of his position as the son of the vice president, having him on that board just basically was like a networking decision. He didn't have to do anything. He was just opening doors to get them to do business in the United States and then funneling a lot of money to both him and his father for giving them those opportunities, which looks like the Senate's looking into has like a lot of corruption possibilities on it. But probably even more concerning than that is actually some of the deals he had in China, which I'm not sure if they're illegal yet. They're still looking into that, but definitely unethical or unpatriotic, to where selling like American auto parts manufacturer that's making military grade equipment and then having his father's presidential administration or as the vice president for Obama approve that sale to China. Or there was another one that was pretty concerning, to where the Biden family was making just tons of money supporting the Chinese coal industry, even as Obama and Biden are campaigning around the nation that coal's not environmentally friendly. We have to shut down America's coal mining. And then so you start looking at these business ventures and you're like, okay, well, you're not necessarily against coal mining. You're just against American coal mining, because the Chinese are paying you millions of dollars to support their coal mining industry. Which, it would take a long time to go through all these details. But we've already talked a little bit in the program about the parallels between ancient Israel in the time of Jeroboam and America today, and that is a big theme throughout the book of Amos, especially Amos 6, 7, and 8, about these wealthy business elites in the nation who sell their nation's interest out to foreign powers. In ancient Israel, it was primarily them trading with the Assyrians and them trading with the Egyptians. And then Amos 6 talks about these businessmen that lay out on beds of ivory and listen to music and drink wine as their own people are suffering. And it is just really a kind of a poetic description of what you'd see in what President Trump would call the swamp today, not just the Biden family, but the Clinton family and many of the political dynasties in Washington that have these behind-the-scenes business contracts with China, selling out American uranium and American coal and American steel and American manufacturing to the Chinese in order to enrich their own families by hurting their nation's national security.
Well, that prophecy is explained in greater detail in an article that Andrew wrote earlier this month that's on thetrumpet.com. New Senate report reveals Biden family business corruption. Go check that out. We'll link to it in the show notes if you can't find it on the front page. Thank you very much, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Helen Keller. I long to accomplish a great and noble task, but it is my chief duty to accomplish small tasks as if they were great and noble. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.